Media recognition from Bloomberg, Reuters, Recycling Trade Publications. Patented process for 100% recovery of critical metals, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, aluminum. American Manganese is focused on recycling lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. American Manganese trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, the U.S., AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit AmericanManganeseInc.com or phone me, Larry Ray, at 778-574-4444.
Welcome to the Goddard Report. Comments made on the Goddard Report and TalkDigitalNetwork.com are an expression of opinion only. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Doug Bebb. He's the candidate for the People's Party of Canada in the riding of West Vancouver Sunshine Coast Sea to Sky Country in British Columbia. His website, bebppc.ca, that's bebppc.ca, a good tongue twister for you. Doug, welcome to the Goddard Report.
Glad to be here, Jim.
Doug, last week you were part of an all-candidates meeting in Gibson's, British Columbia. What happened?
Well, the meeting was arranged. We all went there in person. We had about 50 people in attendance. They were all masked. And the protocols were correctly followed. And then the four establishment parties began to get cold feet because they suspected I wasn't vaccinated. Now, that's just a cover story. The truth of the matter is that the audience was there. They had no idea what the vaccine status of the audience was either. But they went outside and had a little huddle and decided they'd flee the scene and go home and do this from Skype. And so I and the other independent candidate stayed there. We participated directly, and we had our say. The audio quality was a mess. They had, like, lots of good cameras there, and, you know, they're all ready to go. And, you know, the Skype thing was last minute. It didn't work very well. The audio content was badly degraded, and so the thing kind of fizzled. They had me initially in this sort of plexiglass cage, you know, for their safety, because they're really worried that maybe somebody in their presence wasn't vaccinated. 4 days before that, both Abby Lewis and Patrick Wyler, Lewis being the NDP candidate and Wyler the Liberal candidate, they were seen, and I was up on Bowen Island at Bowfest, and these guys were out roaming around with hundreds of people rubbing elbows, you know. So this was clear hypocrisy. It was a theater. And the idea that, you know, unvaccinated people are any more of a threat than vaccinated people is sheer nonsense. The vaccine itself is never intended to prevent disease. Vaccinated people can spread the disease. And this attempt to segregate our society on the basis of vaccine status is mere divisive policy by the Trudeau government, and it's quite frankly disgusting.
Did the other candidates provide vaccine cards?
No, nobody has them. Well, maybe some have them. I can't say for sure. But there was no request to me for any vaccine status card. And the audience, I'm sure, wouldn't have provided that if they were asked.
Aside from your little adventure in Gibson's, how's your campaign going?
Busy. Absolutely run off my feet. I've got all kinds of emails, and phone won't stop ringing. We're getting our signs up. We're doing a better job this time. Donations are up. We've got a bigger budget. I ran 20,000 copies of a brochure into the Sunshine Coast, and pretty soon there's going to be the rest of the riding, which includes West Vancouver and up the Sea to Sky, past where I live as far as Anderson Lake. And I sent you a copy of that. It's well put together. Version 1 had an anti-globalist theme. Version 2 has that, plus more liberal malfeasance, more, you know, rights, Charter of Rights issues. And it's well produced, and I think it's going to be effective.
Is this election about freedom versus the tyranny of being controlled by the establishment?
It always was. I mean, that's the dichotomy. All these isms, you know, like fascism and communism and Marxism, they're on the side of government control, and on the other side of the spectrum is individual freedom. So this is always the case, you know, in the relationship of the citizens and of a society in general. You know, the idea that communism's on the left and, you know, fascism is on the right is just false. And all these isms have at core a confluence or an agreement between government and industry or business in order to enrich the minority and to subjugate the people. And they all end up that way, you know, with different paths. You know, communists take over directly through force. You know, we have right now a creeping nexus between these two with social media, big pharma, all these collusions between government and industry at the expense of the citizens is the problem. And so that's where we're at. And, you know, Trudeau calling an unnecessary election and then not soon after, not long after, making this vaccine passport issue the primary focus of the election was just a strange move on his part. I mean, he's enraged the entire population, at least a lot of it, and it would seem to be working against him as it, you know, would likely have done. I mean, it probably could be predicted what would happen, but he did it anyways. And so those are the cards we're dealt. We're, you know, fighting this election on the basis of passing passports, but that is simply the latest manifestation of this ongoing struggle between state control and individual rights.
You have a banner on your large election signs, it says, "End the corruption." How widespread is corruption in Canadian governments and politics?
Well, I think it's very, very prevalent. It, you know, Canada has long had a reputation internationally of being, you know, a well-run, clean country, and more it's not the case. We have corruption here, and, you know, in every case, what I mean by corruption is that public policy is influenced by special interest groups who want some special favors from government. And so the money flows back to the party in power, and the favors flow in the other direction to the party seeking these favors. You can do, maybe I can cook up a little kind of example here, you know. We'll talk about, let's talk about country C and corporation S. And so, you know, country C is intent upon helping the third world. They have all sorts of programs to funnel money, to do development programs. And let's just say that some of these, you know, programs overseas require content in terms of engineering services and whatnot. And so these contracts are then let with the caveat or the condition that Canadian, or the content from country C is used. And so, you know, the recipient of this largesse overseas then employs company S to do this work. And then, of course, you know, the problem becomes how to get the money back into the hands of the rulers of country. And they get caught doing that by reimbursing, you know, the individuals who make contributions. And then you look for another, you know, avenue. And the way it's structured in Canada, if you're aware, Elections Canada publishes the names and addresses in some cases of donors. Depending upon how much they donate, it's over $200, they put your name publicly on the website. And if it's over $400, I think they put your name and address. Not the address, but the postal code. No telephone number. But this is public information, you know, and the Human Resources Department of Company S has access to this, and they can see who makes donations. And, you know, it'd be easy from there to say, okay, well, not in an overt way, but, perhaps your bonus at the end of the year depends upon what gets listed on the Elections Canada site. So if business is creative, they can get around these things, but always follow the money. You know, it's a circular flow. It's special interest getting favors and money going back to corrupt politicians.
Doug, isn't this exactly what the SNC-Lavalin scandal was all about? And we had our first Aboriginal Attorney General point out, hey, look, we're not going to drop criminal charges against SNC-Lavalin. She ended up being booted out of the Trudeau government. And the company, very quietly, one of their officials was sentenced to 9 years in jail over this. So there was something criminal going on, and the Prime Minister just said, it's about jobs. If we prosecute them, SNC-Lavalin will collapse, costing all these jobs. But of course, if you check the job boards, the demand for engineers has never been higher.
Well, let me say that any similarity between my hypothetical, you know, company S and the SNC-Lavalin would be purely coincidental.
Yep.
I just take a jobs issue up.
Yep.
You know, the idea that corporations are artificial persons, you know, for the purpose of entering into contracts, you know, they can be sued civilly if they damage things, you know, and so there's this corporate shield in most cases for the boards of directors of these corporations, you know, for the things they do in a, you know, contractual sense. And that doesn't extend in every case to, you know, things that are, let's just say they don't pay wages, you know. So, you know, when you have a wind-up of a corporation, you end up with, you know, a pecking order of creditors. And, of course, the government's first in line and, you know, all these people who didn't get paid, they're high in priority. And so, you know, this kind of penetrates the shield, the corporate shield for boards of directors. And to my way of thinking, that's good. But this corporate shield, this liability shield should not extend to criminal activity, which is what we're talking about here. And so, you know, in the case of SNC-Lavalin, where they talk about, you know, immunity from these sorts of things based upon jobs, well, you know, it's not the corporation committed the criminal acts. It is the people who ran that corporation up into and including the board of directors, and that shield should not extend to them. These people should be prosecuted. And so it's a bit of a dodge to argue that, you know, it's a corporation that's going to suffer and, you know, it's going to be all these job things. It's the people behind the scenes that need to be prosecuted, not the corporation. Corporations can't, you know, commit criminal acts. They have no consciousness. In law, they call that mens rea or malice aforethought. It's not the corporation that's responsible for the stuff. It's the people that made the decisions, and they're the ones that need to be prosecuted. So
how has political corruption hurt Canada and the people of Canada over the past few decades?
Well, there's a couple of aspects to that. First of all, you know, we're doing this with our money, and it's a waste of our money. And of course, whenever you have this corruption, it distorts the political process as well. You know, through these donations and all this stuff. You know, we got the same thing going on with, this dairy cartel, you know. I mean, people in Canada pay at least twice, maybe more for eggs and milk and poultry than they do across the border. And, you know, it was back in, I think, the 70s that Trudeau the first, put this marketing, supply management, system into place. Now, there's somewhere in an order of, I think, I'm making numbers up now, but 70 or 80,000 small farmers involved in this, dairy product back then. And then, you know, they went down to like 20 or 30. It was a big reduction. And now you have to have a permit in Canada to milk a cow, you know? And so the price goes up, people pay more, and if you're looking, you know, as a creative person to try and circumvent the election rules in Canada, what you're looking for is some industry or some special group that's distributed over a large number of people, each of which can make the full $1,650 donation every year, right? So dairy families fit that bill quite well, as do others, you know. And so, again, we have interest. And by the way, you know, this was put in by the Liberals. And, you know, it is not a conservative principle to distort markets to the benefit of some and to hurt the free market mechanism. And yet that's exactly what we saw with Andrew Scheer and the conservatives. The conservatives, they have no principles. They're blowing in the wind, whatever the latest poll tells them, you know, where their money comes from. So they're actually supporting supply management, which was put in by Trudeau, because they want the money. And now we see O'Toole waffling on vaccine passports. You know, somebody probably ran a poll and they thought, well, we'll just get, you know, a few more votes and a few ridings and we'll do better in the polls or in the election because, you know, that's what people in this particular riding think. And he flip-flops. Now he's for vaccine passports. This is not conservative principled policy. This is the action of somebody who simply wants to get back to the trough to begin to feed because he thinks it's his turn. So I forgot where I was going with that, but maybe the next question.
Has corruption allowed the globalists to get a tighter grip on Canada?
Sure it has. You know, all the money that gets misappropriated through this overseas connection, you know, whether it's through the Soros Foundation or some of these ENGOs, this is all taxpayer money. And we're actually funding our own subversion, for lack of a better word. And the globalists are lapping up all this stuff. I mean, Suzuki gets all kinds of money. He shows up as a interested intervener in these lawsuits. It's all funded by the government to our detriment.
Doug, vaccine passports seem to be the big issue of this election instead of freedom, safety, and prosperity for the people of Canada. What are the vaccine passports really about?
I wish I knew. The one thing they're not about is public health. I mean, there's lots of evidence. In fact, it's flat-out fact that the vaccine does not prevent infection. Neither does it prevent transmission. Now, so I can go into great detail about this, probably not here, but the initial clinical trials for these mRNA vaccines only addressed the severity of symptoms and tried to prevent bad outcomes. There's no efficacy, either tested or indicated, for preventing disease. And now we see that there is strong evidence that the nasal titers, which is the concentration of virions in the sinuses, is actually several hundred times higher in the vaccinated cohort than it is in the unvaccinated cohort. And so it's quite likely that these vaccinated people are incubating, you know, these strains of concern, although I'm not really particularly concerned myself, and probably are spreading the disease in greater numbers than the unvaccinated cohort. And so the idea that you're going to protect anybody with a piece of paper or an electronic equivalent on your smartphone is complete nonsense. And these public health officials know this. Bonnie Henry knows this. And the people that looked at this probably made the conclusion from that Bonnie Henry is just flat out lying. I don't know why. I mean, some people have speculated that, this has got some malign intent, and it may well have, but motivation is hard to determine, you know, based upon, unless you have, documented signed evidence. We can only speculate as to what they're really up to, but I'm pretty sure personally that one of their objectives is simply to bring in population control to make people compliant. The other prong of that attack is that once you have all these people on CERB and they become dependent upon government handouts, they're less likely to bite the hand that feeds them. So now you've got this electronic mechanism to track them. You've got, you know, the dependency on government that makes them compliant and complacent. And these, in fact, my friend, are the way that you can slide a country slowly into Marxist dictatorship. You know, when they brought this into the Soviet Union, you know, after the First World War and the Bolshevik Revolution, there wasn't a lot of people that were, you know, enthusiastic about communism. They just thought it was easier and less dangerous personally to go along with these programs. And so, you know, the people today that think, well, you know, we're going to just kind of ride this out and everything will be fine in the end as long as we keep our heads down, they're incorrect, and they're going to get bitten as a result.
Justin Trudeau has spoken out about Agenda 2030, the Great Reset, where you will own nothing and be happy about it. Your thoughts on that?
Well, that's all build back better, shall we? And what exactly do they mean by better? You've seen these collages of video clips where all of the politicians across the Western world are saying, let's build back better. Well, my question for them is, better for whom? Better for you? Better for me? Or better for the 1%?
Is the climate change narrative being pushed by the same people who want to reduce the population?
Well, again, we come back to the question of motive, you know. I think it's the same people. Whether or not that's their motive remains to be seen. There's evidence that suggests that's the case. And, you know, if it's so, if that's the case, and these people have a stated goal of reducing population, they've talked about it for decades, right? And if that's the case, you have to ask yourself, you know, if that truly is their goal, what can we make of their current claims to want to save everybody by vaccinating them? These two things don't coexist. They're antithetical. So they're lying either in first instance or in the second or possibly in both.
Mark Carney, the former governor of the Bank of Canada and the Bank of England's name keeps popping up. What's he up to?
Facilitating the takeover of our country. You know, he's an interesting guy. He was a governor of the Bank of Canada. He moved over to the UK to be their, well, they call it, the Chancellor of the Exchequer or the central bank there. And now he's got some appointment as a special advisor to the UN on the climate matter. And his plan is to accelerate this, you know, greening, if you want, of the economy by funneling capital into his preferred companies. You know, so if you meet these criteria, then you'll be able to get financing for your corporation. And if you don't, too bad, we'll cut you off from the capital markets. So, you know, this is another backdoor prong to twist the economic landscape. And I should add that, you know, if you're able to basically pick winners and losers by either, you know, flooding them with capital or denying them access to capital, well, then you know which stocks to buy, don't you? That's Carney for you.
Is election fraud a concern?
Ooh, not so much in Canada. You know, all sorts of evidence in the U.S. that they did all sorts of stuff there to subvert that election. I think the evidence is quite credible. I think that, you know, the courts were terrified to take the matter up, and so they basically dragged their feet until Biden was declared the president. At which point they declared the whole matter moot and moved on, you know, with their hands over their eyes. So the machine counting is a huge problem. And we don't have that issue in Canada. Other than, I think, a few provinces. And, of course, the systems is used in the leadership conventions for both the Conservative and the Liberal parties. In fact, there's an interesting picture on the Internet of Justin Trudeau with his iPad voting on he's in his own election, I guess in 2015 or 14 or whatever it was, on the, and I think Soros's son or nephew was in the background of that picture. So these guys, you know, they're all hooked in with this corruption and every aspect of it. But in Canada, we don't have these voting machines implemented federally. What we have is a paper ballot still. And so I have more faith that we're doing things properly in Canada. The only caveats would be, you know, the mail-in ballots, and particularly the ballots that come from overseas, from people who are Canadian citizens, but haven't lived in this country for a decade. So I asked the returning officer in my riding, well, how do you count these overseas votes? And he told me that they get attributed to the riding, which was the last known address of the expat Canadian overseas. So at least they're not like allocating them, you know, to ridings where they need a few more votes to win. So the allocation of these overseas votes, I think is, you know, frankly, if you don't live in a riding, you don't get to vote in that riding. And I'm starting to think that perhaps all these overseas people shouldn't be allowed to vote at all. But, then the, you know, the increase in the, unless if you, you know, if you have a, maintain a residence in Canada, that would be fine. But if you move lock, stock, and barrel, you know, somewhere else and haven't lived in this country and you're just a Canadian of convenience because you want the passport, I'm starting to think maybe they shouldn't be voting. And then the issue of these mail-in ballots that are going to go up into large numbers because this terrible COVID thing is afflicting us all. You know, that, I think, he said was going to be counted locally at the, returning office for the riding. You know, hopefully, there won't be too many fake ballots mailed in and the processes around them, at least on paper, look good. I mean, our returning officer here is quite a trustworthy character, and I have some faith that we'll get a decent result overall.
Canada is divided. Do you think Canada can be united?
Yeah, I think so. We're divided in a couple of ways, actually many ways. You know, we're divided at provincial level because of unfair policy as regards transfer payments, equalization. You know, the fact that federal Canada has taken control of environmental policy, you know, has infuriated Alberta and other provinces that are, there's a nascent separatist movement, you know, is growing. I think that you're going to see in Alberta that the Wild Rose Independence Party is going to be really, really strong there. I know most of those guys that are at several conventions. They're all out for the same purpose. In the meeting I told you underground there back in March of this year, where all these people were in attendance, like Max and Derek Sloan and the Wild Rose guys, and, you know, it was pretty clear that the initial steps to be taken, whether or not we have a separate, you know, Quebec and a separate Alberta, this has to be accomplished at the provincial level. And so before that could happen, Alberta's going to have to get its house in order. You need your own pension plan to ensure that your civil servants are taken care of. You need your own police force to get Ottawa out of that aspect. You need your own tax collection. You need all these things are preconditions to separation. And for that to happen, you need to have a provincial premier that's on board and will put these things into place. And so we don't have, I don't think anyways, in my opinion, we don't have, you know, an urgent, imminent, successful separatist movement in Alberta, although that might happen. But along the way, the very things that Alberta wants are the same things that the People's Party is advocating for. And so there's a huge opportunity to collaborate, and we're going to do that, with the Wild Rose Party. And at the end of the day, I think if we have all these pieces in place and Alberta has autonomy, same as Quebec, and maybe to a greater extent, then the separatist movement there will stay in Canada. And they'll think, okay, well, we've got the things that we need within a looser confederation, and we're happy to stay. And that, in fact, was the title and theme of Max's address to that crowd. It's called Radical Decentralization, and it basically allows the provinces the same, you know, control, the same autonomy that Quebec now has, and basically defangs Ottawa. It gets Ottawa out of the hair of the provinces, and, you know, that speech that Max gave in the very epicenter of conservative Alberta to a largely separatist crowd drew a standing ovation. So I think there's plenty of opportunity, there's plenty of time to reunite this country. And, you know, all these other prongs of division that are being foisted on the Canadian people from vaccine passports, you know, we have to get these guys out of office. We need to take a broom to Ottawa. We may even have to fumigate the place. And then we're going to have policy that speaks to, you know, the individual autonomy of provinces, of people, and just get this thing back on track, and I think we'll be able to save this country. In fact, you're going to find a short video podcast interview of me on my website there, when I talk about exactly these issues when I was down in Montreal last September at a rally. I mean, that's what we're here for. We're here to put Canada back on a better track. We don't like the track we're on, and we're determined to put our country on a better one.
We'll have more with Doug Bebb right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Doug Bebb. Doug, Canada is a resource-based economy. How important is a fully functioning resource industry to the Canadian economy?
Well, we are, and we will be for the foreseeable future. And I think it's essential that we have, you know, a properly functioning resource industry. Although my personal preference would be to repatriate a lot of manufacturing back into this country. You know, the whole outsourcing of productive capacity of this nation to China and elsewhere around the world has really impacted the well-being of our Canadian workers. You know, you look at economics and you've got, you know, these models that suggest that, you know, both parties would benefit from trade given, you know, the competitive advantage of some regions over others to produce certain goods and services. This is fine, except that when you begin to arbitrage capital, when you have all this capital mobility, you know, when you start building factories overseas, not because they have some advantage, but because they will have an advantage in the future, then you start to distort the whole labor market. And I think we should bring back these manufacturing jobs, you know, the Ontario heartland and elsewhere. We have to put some in Alberta, you know. Not that we're going to do this as a matter of mandate from government policy, but we need to have, you know, not just a resource economy, but a healthy, robust manufacturing economy here. The idea that you can, you know, do it all overseas is really an attempt to arbitrage both labor and pollution. And, you know, if these green people are correct, which I don't think they are, you know, they would be more concerned about the carbon dioxide emissions from China, you know, that come back into Canada built into the goods that they buy from there. You know, and the other thing I want to say about that now is, you know, they're all of the opinion that this global warming and carbon dioxide is a global problem, and yet they have a very myopic view of Canada, which is a very small emitter, and were we, in fact, to reduce our carbon dioxide emissions to zero, it would make no difference in the global setting, because China and India are all building coal plants for electricity generation hundreds a year. And, you know, there's another initiative here to curtail our resource economy by cutting off coal exports to China, you know, as a frankly idiotic attempt to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. You know, the Greens do not have any viable plan. They can cut off all the, you know, coal exports out of the West Coast here, and the Chinese will simply buy coal from, you know, Australia or elsewhere in the Donbass. They've got all kinds of coal around the world. We're not the only ones that have this resource. And to cut that off with the negative effect on our workers, on our economy, it's just madness. I don't think these Greens have any idea what they're doing. And in fact, if you really believe in this whole carbon dioxide issue, nuclear would be the way to go. But they don't like that either. What we're dealing with is a bunch of globalists, you know, and they have basically the perennial malcontents. They just don't want anybody to be prosperous and to have their freedom. And I think they have to go.
Is inflation the big financial story right now?
Oh, it's going to be. It is going to be. Let me tell you, this is, there's two aspects to this. This whole COVID thing has basically destroyed the productive capacity of the world. And the government spending on the other side is going to keep demand growing. And so we got this situation where there's less supply and more demand. And right now you're seeing it in shortages. I couldn't buy a fridge. It took me 8 months to get one. You know, it's not very far from there to the price of fridges going up. And that's what's going to happen next. And, it's already in the food markets. You know, you go down to the grocery store, you're paying way more. Restaurants are up. You know, I do a bit of traveling still, you know, mostly on this political matter now. You know, you're paying $150 for a motel I used to get for 50, you know. So everywhere you see inflation. Everywhere except for in the official statistics. Unless you look at John Williams down at shadowstats.com, who's still calculating these numbers as they used to be calculated back before they started jigging them around and fiddling with them. You know, the procedure for calculating inflation has changed over the years. And of course, you know, with those changes, the inflation seemed to disappear magically. But John Williams does that. He used to work for them, and he does it in the same fashion they used to do it. And if you look at his inflation numbers, his unemployment numbers, you're going to be shocked. It's shadowstats.com.
Are Canadian stock markets benefiting from growing inflation?
Well, I guess so. I would say that, you know, when people recognize that inflation is here, they're going to want to buy, you know, hard assets that will appreciate with inflation. And so any sorts of things like housing stock, farmland, precious metals, some people even argue for, you know, art, anything other than, you know, debt instruments and cash in the bank will be in demand. And so, you know, you got to look at inflation in two ways. You know, there's the consumer price inflation I talk about at your grocery store. Then there's asset inflation. And certainly, you know, stock markets fall into the asset category, and they will probably go up as a result of this inflation. But it's not going to be good for the average citizen.
Is inflation good for eliminating debts?
Yep, I think so. You know, if you're a debtor, you're better off in an inflationary environment. If you're, you know, a saver or, you know, a creditor, then you've got a problem. Now, you know, if you do this at the government level, it's probably going to reduce your debt in real terms by inflating it away, but it's going to really hurt the citizenry. So yeah, they could inflate the debt away, and then you'll pay $100 for a hamburger, but that's not a good way to go. And so the answer to your question is yes, but it's not really good policy.
How important is a stable Canadian dollar to the success of Canada?
Well, we want a stable Canadian dollar. But a stable Canadian dollar is dependent upon getting the central bank under control. And the idea that you can, like, have a built-in inflation of, you know, 2 or 3% a year, even if it's fictitiously reported, is a 2 to 3% taxation on the savings of Canadians. You know, you can have growth in money supply that matches the kind of economic growth and end up with a stable dollar. And again, both need to be calculated in a manner that's accurate for that equivalency to be accurate. So we need to have real inflation numbers. We need to have, you know, real productive numbers, not cooked up ones. But were you to have a match between the growth in the monetary supply and the growth in the economy, you would end up with a stable dollar, right? Could be either way. You know, you could have a slower growth in money supply and end up with a deflationary environment. And you can have what we have now, which is, you know, a money supply created out of thin air by the Bank of Canada to fund government deficits well in excess of the growth of productive capacity of the nation, and have, you know, an inflationary environment. To target, you know, a 2 to 3% inflation rate is, in fact, a de facto 2 to 3% tax rate on the savings of all Canadians. And so what we want to do is to set a zero inflation rate target for the Bank of Canada. You know, they talk about this, you know, independence of these central banks. It's a bunch of hooey. These guys talk behind doors all the time, you know. And so the idea that central banks can act with, you know, autonomy, and it's a better way because there's going to be political influence if there's you know, discussions. It's a false claim. And so, you know, we're not going to tell them how much money to print, but we're going to tell them, listen, we want to have no inflation in this country, and a strong dollar is going to provide, you know, the good foundation for economic prosperity and growth.
Could lower taxes lead to a strengthening economy and prosperity for Canadians?
I think so. But I think also important in that question is the fact that, you know, a lower tax rate reduces the size of government. It's good for freedom. It's good for individuals who want to make their own decisions. And the People's Party of Canada is of the opinion that we should let Canadians make their own choices about what they want to do with their bodies, with vaccine passports, with their money. If they want to donate to various causes, that's up to them, and we're happy to do that. But the idea that we can, you know, print money and hand it around for all Canadians is just not what we want to do. We want to have people, and we trust them to make their own choices. You know, this is a matter of individual choice and freedom over decisions being made by a government that really, in a lot of cases, does not have the interests of the average Canadian at heart, even though they say they do. I mean, Jagmeet Singh runs around saying, you know, how he's going to help the common man, and he's this great humanitarian. But taxing them and taking that decision-making ability out of the hands of the individual is not good for anybody.
Maxime Bernier is the only federal political leader who has mentioned upping the personal tax exemption before you as an individual have to start paying federal income tax. Is that a good idea?
Yes. Yeah, the other part to that was that we not only want to reduce taxes, but we want to have a simplification of the tax structure. That was the part I'd missed when I was answering the question, first of all. And so there's really no point in having, you know, taxes and complicated tax codes apply to people that don't earn a great deal of money. And so the exemption for low-income earners makes sense, not only because we don't like taxes or taxing the the lowest income workers, but we don't want to have a unnecessary paper burden as well. So there's a two-pronged aspect to that question. I'm sorry I missed the second part.
We hear there's a real estate bubble in Canada. By adding inflation to the real estate bubble, could prices increase, or could the bubble burst due to the lack of affordability?
Well, affordability for whom? You know, the average person is going to have a hard time buying a house. So I can see why some might think the bubble would burst because people can't buy houses. Out here on the West Coast, we have empty houses and homeless. And the reason for this is, you know, the use of offshore one percenters to buy these hard assets, in particular housing in Canada, you know, to dodge taxes and to launder money, you know? And you have to ask yourself why it is that nothing's been done about this despite its discussion for decades. You know, a real attack on this criminal activity would involve the RCMP, Customs and Border, and our FinCEN equivalent in Canada, all of which are federal agencies. And, you know, you have to ask yourself why it is that they haven't put together, you know, a comprehensive investigation of all this stuff. Simply follow the money. And when it's with, things like this happen, actually don't happen, that should happen, it's almost always because somebody in government or in the system don't want that change to be made. So I think that'd be a good question for Patrick Wilder or Trudeau and the Liberals. Why is it that they have not gone after this when they have the ability? It's simply a matter of organizing the right departments to get this done. It's insane that we have all these empty houses, you know, and people homeless. And, it's all because that these houses are being traded offshore as an investment asset, you know, basically to get around the banking system. And one of the ways they do this is they, you know, they have a corporation, they put the house in the corporation, and then the corporation changes hands, and there's no, you know, housing transfer tax. The thing becomes a tradable asset, and you don't have to be in Canada. You can buy a bunch of houses, you know, that are the property of a corporation. So there's a lot of ways they're doing it, and the result is we have homeless and empty houses at the same time. It's completely wrong, and we're going to have to fix that, I think.
Justin Trudeau was asked about monetary policy, and he said he doesn't think about it. How important is it for the Prime Minister to think about monetary policy?
Well, you know, if you think the budget's going to balance itself, as Trudeau has claimed in past election cycle, then I guess there's no need worrying about this, eh? So, the budget is, you know, what's driving the Bank of Canada and printing money at record rates out of thin air, and it's going to end up in inflation. And it wouldn't surprise me if they have the real numbers there at the Liberal Party, and they know this is coming. And that might have formed part of the reason why they've called this unnecessary early election. Might be necessary from their perspective, because they know that a bunch of bad stuff's coming down the pipe, and they want to get out ahead of it with a 4-year term before it hits the fan and comes home to roost.
What is the People's Party's plan to get Canada back on track?
Well, we're going to eliminate all these vaccine passport mandates and, these Liberals' COVID-19 measures are destroying our charter rights and freedoms. We'll honor the charter by rescinding all federal COVID-19 lockdown and vaccine mandates. We have to unify Canada. The Liberals have infuriated the West and are now segregating us with vaccine passports. We will respect and act on the needs of each region. We'll ban vaccine passports. We'll get back to work. Open up our economy. As to the causes of this whole COVID thing, the Liberals are slavishly following the globalist agendas the WHO and the UN. We're going to fire Theresa Tam, withdraw from the Paris Agreement. We're going to open up our exports, put pipelines both ways across this country. We're going to end censorship so we can discuss these matters freely and get back to a properly functioning democracy. I'm going to clean out Ottawa. The Prime Minister has been found guilty of breaking the ethics rules many times. And we're going to model the highest standards of honesty and fidelity into our public office and take a broom to the place. And then immigration reform, too. We're going to do that. It's going to be capped at 150,000 based upon, you know, the economic advantage to Canada. We need immigration. Maybe not so much now with high unemployment rate, but in order to grow, we do need some immigration. We need those immigrants who are, you know, working and contributing and paying taxes to our country. And know that 350 or 450,000 or how many they've got now slated for immigration every year under the Liberal plan is equivalent to about the population of New Brunswick every 2 years. Now we just can't, we can't absorb that many. And, you know, it's impacting not only housing availability and pricing. You know, we've got medical wait times. We've got school and daycare placement overcrowding. And so we're not going to be importing another province into this country every 2 years.
Doug, thank you so much for chatting with us. Where can people follow you and your campaign?
Well, you can follow me on my website. It's bebppc.ca. That's my last name. It's Bravo Echo, Bravo, Bravo, ppc.ca. I've got some information there on banking, on COVID, on climate. And, of course, there's a section on myself. I have a few video updates there, and the next one's going to be a full-featured interview I had with the Peak newspaper here last night. Probably covered a lot of the same topics. But the People's Party is the party of freedom, of individual freedom. And I think a lot more young people today are realizing that that actually is important. So I want to thank you for your time, Jim. And I think you're going to really enjoy your upcoming interview with Brad Nickerson, our candidate for Burnaby North Seymour, who is pretty much our resident expert on the legal aspects of COVID. And I guess that's all from Whistler. Have a nice day.
Good luck, Doug.
Thank you.
My guest has been Doug Bebb, People's Party of Canada, Canada candidate in the riding of West Vancouver, Sunshine Coast, Sea to Sky Country. If you have any questions for Doug or any of our other guests, we'd be glad to ask that question on your behalf the next time we talk to them. If you send that question to info@howstreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on the Goddard Report and TalkDigitalNetwork.com are an expression of opinion only. The Goddard Report is available online and mobile at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. The Goddard Report is a production of How Street Media Incorporated.